You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Morning, everyone, and welcome. Thank you for braving the elements. I have a much bigger turnout than I anticipated, given the weather. My name is Will McCants. I direct the project on U.S. relations with the Islamic world here at Brookings. This morning, we are here to discuss a new Brookings paper entitled Be Afraid, Be a Little Afraid, The Threat of Terrorism from Western Foreign Fighters in Syria and Iraq. It's a joint paper between the Brookings Center on the United States and Europe and the Brookings Center for Middle East Policy. Given events over the past few days in Paris, the topic is more pertinent now than it has ever been. In the first part of this morning's panel, the two authors of the paper are going to share their findings with you. And afterwards, Ambassador Daniel Benjamin will comment on the paper. Briefly introducing the panel, to my immediate right is Jeremy Shapiro, who's a fellow with the Project on International Order and Strategy at the Center and at the Center on United States and Europe at Brookings. To his right is Dan Byman, who is Director of Research and a Senior Fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at Brookings. And Dan is also a professor in Georgetown University Security Studies Program. And to his right, as Ambassador Dan Benjamin, is a non-resident senior fellow here at Brookings at the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence. He is also currently the director of the John Sloan Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth College. Dan previously served as ambassador at large and coordinator for counterterrorism at the U.S. State Department. Dan Byman.
Thank you, Will, and again, thank you all very much for coming out on a day that, frankly, I'm not sure I would have come out to hear me. So I hope you find this somewhat worthwhile. For quite some time now, really, I would say 2 years, American and European security officials have been tremendously concerned about the threat that Westerners would go off to fight in Syria and now Syria and Iraq and come back home and do terrorist attacks. And in some ways, 2014 seemed, from their eyes, to be a transitional year. You had huge numbers of individuals from the West going off to fight. You had in Belgium an attack on the Jewish Museum there by someone who did return that killed 3 people. And also you had the rise of the Islamic State, a very dangerous group, a group that in the region itself has proven exceptionally bloody and almost cartoonishly evil. And so this concern seemed endlessly justified. And what people often had in mind was Afghanistan, especially before 9/11. That what's happening in Syria and Iraq would prove an incubator, prove something that we would see the repercussions of in the years to come. When Jeremy and I began our research, we began, at least I began, by thinking about, frankly, mistakes I had made in my own research in the past. And it's 2014 now, or 2015 now, excuse me. Back in around 2005, I remember going to Europe, talking to European security officials, who were tremendously concerned about Western foreign fighters going off to fight in Iraq. And they talked that this was going to be a much bigger problem than Afghanistan had ever been, and this concern was echoed by very serious experts, people I respect, and I said it as well. And it was not a problem, at least not to the degree that people expected. You did not see a massive wave of attacks emanating from returnees to Iraq. We've also seen Somalia. We've seen Mali. And so these conflicts where Western foreign fighters have gone have not always or even often produced significant waves of terrorist attacks back on the West. And so the question really is, what's happening in Syria more akin to Afghanistan before 9/11? Or is it something that's more akin to Iraq in the past or other countries? Now, the model that I think security officials have in their mind, Jeremy and I broke down into 5 parts. The first part is you have the conflict raging, and it radicalizes people. That individuals who might not have joined a jihadist organization are upset by the violence, upset by the conflict, and they become supportive of violence. And then in step 2, they go abroad to fight. They travel to the war zone. And then step 3, there they train, they fight, and especially they're indoctrinated. So while they're there, they gain more skills because they've learned to fight, but they also gain a different mindset where they may have gone abroad because they care about, say, the suffering of the Syrian people. But while they're there, they link the Syrian cause to anti-Western causes in general. And then they come home. And finally, they do attacks at home, and also they recruit others. They have a credibility because of their own experience that enables them to keep the cycle going and even expand it. And one of the best studies out there by Thomas Heghammer found that foreign fighters, one in nine is involved in international terrorism, which is actually an extremely high number. Right? Sounds low, but it's extremely high. And that these individuals are often behind some of the more lethal attacks. And you could argue, looking at the situation, that Syria is even worse than past conflicts. The number of Western foreign fighters who have gone to Syria is more than all other modern jihads combined. More than Afghanistan, more than Iraq, all of these combined, we've seen more go to Syria. It's exceptionally easy to travel to Syria, especially through Turkey. You have a number of groups there that are exceptionally radical. And people especially talk about the importance of social media in grabbing onto people, radicalizing them, giving them an easy way to go back and forth to the conflict zone. So why don't we see as much violence, or why didn't we see as much violence as was expected in other cases? And a lot of what our paper lays out are what we call mitigating factors, right? Where we're trying to say that this model I've described does hold true, but there are many off-ramps. Let's start with the obvious ones. First of all, many of the radicals die. Right? They're going to a war zone. And Afghanistan before 9/11 actually saw a very low death rate. The estimate is roughly 5%. Chechnya, in contrast, saw a death rate over 90%. Right? So you have a highly variable death rate, but many die. And you look at the first American who is a suicide bomber in Syria. He was a suicide bomber in Syria, right? So this is of concern because he was radicalized, he went to the war zone, but he died there, right? And he could have perhaps done an attack on the United States, but he preferred to die in the war zone. And also, some people who might do attacks in the West because they're already radicalized might go to Syria or Iraq instead, right? So a number of attacks we've seen elsewhere, so Australia, for example, where individuals did attacks, had they gone to Syria, they might have actually died in the war zone rather than attacked on their home soil. Of those who go and survive, some never return home. Sometimes they burn their passports, sometimes the group takes away their passport, and many of these people often want to stay and keep fighting. They're committed to jihad, they're committed to establishing an Islamic State, what have you, but they don't really want to go home. Of those who go home, some have no intention of attacking there, right? There is an American who went to Somalia who was quoted as saying, you know, why would I want to do an attack at home? My mom could be walking down the street. Right, and that he sees home and away as a very different sort of issue. This is especially true in, I would say, a case like Syria, because many people are disillusioned by the war. These are incredibly brutal wars. A lot of the killing involves killing of other Muslims. And so some of the people who come back don't come back thinking that it was a fantastic experience. In fact, they think quite the opposite. The training received is often training as a guerrilla, not as a terrorist. Right, and they overlap. Right, you learn how to use firearms. There's similarities, but that's very different than the training Al Qaeda gave people, especially before 9/11, about how to operate in a clandestine organization, how to use code, how to find a safe house, how to evade security services. This is not what currently is being taught in most of the camps where foreigners are going. Now, none of these factors by themselves means there's no danger. Okay, however, if you start to combine them, you start to see that there are many possibilities where a lot of people going, relatively few are going to pose a danger upon response. But there are two in particular I want to highlight as being very important. One is that the groups themselves abroad are focused on the conflict there. Right? Afghanistan before 9/11, we had Al-Qaeda there that wanted to attack the United States and the West. It was an important mission for it. It saw it as its core mission. The Islamic State, Jabhat al-Nusra, other groups may have some ambitions to be broader than Syria and Iraq, but their primary goal is to fight the war. And the people going there, they need a certain number of suicide bombers, they need a certain number of attackers, and they want them to fight the war. And so they're going to do violence there, but that's very different than trying to create a large global organization where people do attacks around the West. One of the biggest ones, though, is the role of the security services. And there's some irony that often security officials ignore their own efficacy in stopping these attacks. And what we hear a lot of when we talk about the danger of this is that there were many plots that were disrupted. And in a way, that shows that there's potential danger. But it also shows the skill of the security services and how good they are at doing what they do. And one of the biggest problems we used to have in counterterrorism intelligence was how to identify someone who had never done an attack, who had never joined a group, who simply showed up on the radar screen only after he did a bombing. And forgive me for using the male pronoun, but we're talking him for the most part. And this individual today, we have a way of detecting, which is he travels to Syria, right? He raises his hand and he goes there, and this travel is monitored. We saw this with some of the reports coming out of France where the individuals were monitored when they went to Yemen, for example. Often intelligence agencies have networks and communities, so they know when people are coming and going. And the travel creates intelligence vulnerabilities that enable detection. And especially social media comes into play here. We think, of course, of social media and its ability to radicalize and so on, but social media is also an intelligence stream, right? If I know who your friends are on Facebook, if I know who your followers are on Twitter, I know a tremendous amount about you. And from an intelligence point of view, you can gain access to an individual's network in a remarkable way. And the people going abroad see themselves as heroes, right? So they're not hiding it. They're not going in a clandestine way. They're proud. They're defending their community. They're taking action. They're killing the apostate, on and on and on. And they brag about it to their friends. So you can gain access and information because they've gone abroad. And so you have, in my view, a greater threat, but also a greater ability to respond to it. The Afghanistan experience in some ways shows this, because you did have, I would say, a relatively small number of people, including Ambassador Benjamin, who were focused on Afghanistan before 9/11, but it was a very small number of people. This was not something we didn't have a Department of Homeland Security. The FBI was not focused on this before 9/11. The shift right after 9/11 was dramatic and had a huge impact. So when the security services start paying attention, you have far more ability to respond. Now, all this said, we're going to see some attacks, right? One thing Jeremy and I wrestled with when we wrote this paper is how to tell people, don't overreact, but at the same time, don't be passive, right? Don't say that there's no danger. Don't say there's no response. In particular, the security services need to be resourced in order to handle this. The question, in some ways, is an exceptionally difficult one, which is, if you think the next 5 years out, how many attacks can Western society handle? We all want that number to be zero. But if we say that if there's one attack, we've lost, that's giving the other side a tremendous victory, and it underestimates our own strength. And this is something that we need to consider, because there will be an attack in the coming years, and that attack may involve some individuals from Syria. But what we want to understand in our work is, how does the Syria experience change the overall dynamic? Does it dramatically increase the number of attacks? Does it make them far more lethal? And our view is, we may see some attacks, but it's not necessarily a dramatic shift, and we need to resource appropriately. So some resources, but not do so in an overwhelming way. Now, I'll put a caveat. Some of the reasons I'm saying this phenomena is serious for the West, but not overwhelming, make it exceptionally serious for the Middle East. Right? There are far more Arab foreign fighters going to Syria, and many of the societies they're coming back to don't have strong security services or the ability to stop this. We also need to think about the long-term influence. One of the fascinating things coming out of France is some of the networks we're talking about, at least based on the initial reporting, actually seem to be linked to the Iraq war I just told you about, that, you know, 10 years ago seemed overwhelming, right, but didn't manifest in massive threats. So these networks can have lasting long-term effects. And when we think about effectiveness and threats, we need to think about those as well. So with those thoughts and caveats, let me turn it over to Jeremy, who's going to talk more about the policy implications of what we've done, but also some of the situation in France today.
Thanks, and thanks to everybody for coming on this rainy day. I've come, even though it was raining, but, you know, I'm more devoted than Dan. As Dan was saying, because terrorism is, at the end of the day, a small numbers phenomenon, the standard of success is not perfection. But we believe in looking at the problem and looking at the model that we created, we can come up with policy recommendations that can at least mitigate the problem. From our standpoint, it's useful to think about the foreign fighter problem as a sort of terrorist production system. And by intervening with smart policies at every stage in the process, there are ways to reduce the numbers of foreign fighters, to reduce the numbers of foreign fighters who become terrorists, and to ultimately to reduce the number of terrorist attacks, essentially decreasing the odds that foreign fighters will become a problem. So we divided it up into five stages, which are in the paper. The first stage is the decision phase, the phase in which foreign fighters decide that they want to go to the field of battle. The effort here is essentially to convince people not to go. A lot of European governments, Danish and UK in particular, have programs for this. They have propaganda efforts. They have hotlines. They have efforts to take down recruitment websites. From our perspective, though, this policy has seen very limited benefits. Governments, frankly, aren't very good at this. If you can think back to the sort of public service announcements from your teenage years telling you not to do drugs, you can get some sense of what I'm talking about. Additionally, when the government gets involved in the war in question, it gets that much harder. And so the U.S. involvement in the Syrian war has made it all the more difficult to convince people. We thought that we need pragmatic rather than theological approaches to this problem. The governments make very bad religious authorities. And so it's not a good idea to try to convince a foreign fighter or potential foreign fighter not to go because it's not Islamically correct or because of the struggle isn't worth the candle, but rather to focus on pragmatic questions which seem to have an effect. A lot of the European security services told us that the most successful they were in convincing people not to go was to focus on infighting, on the fact that there was a lot of Muslim-on-Muslim violence, jihadist-on-jihadist violence in Syria, and that that really had an effect on the idea that people would go. And that overall it was best to rely on the community for this. The community was doing this to some degree organically. The state could reinforce that somewhat, but that it was fundamentally a community task. The second thing to do in this regard is to develop peaceful alternatives for this energy. This turns out to be a little bit difficult. A lot of the foreign fighters who have gone actually don't leave terribly radicalized. They leave with a desire to genuinely help the people in the conflict zone, and they are limited in their ability to do that. So developing charitable activities and mechanisms for humanitarian activities that won't run them afoul of the law is one way of allowing that energy to express itself. From the government standpoint, though, it had to be admitted that this was the stage in which the government was least effective, and it was a stage where it was questionable whether it made a lot of sense to try that hard, because there was more success at later stages, and because because certain radical people leaving the country might actually reduce the chances of terrorist attacks in the future. Second stage is travel. This means disrupting the transit route, especially through Turkey, which was a more promising avenue. A big difference between Syria and previous conflicts, as Dan mentioned, is the ease of travel. The key to this is obviously effective cooperation with Turkey. There are other ways to get to Syria and Iraq, but all are far harder and more costly and dangerous for foreign fighters. Cooperation with Turkey has certainly been hard. They have not always seen stopping foreign fighters who want to overthrow Assad as their highest priority. And Western services have at times been reluctant to share information with Turkish authorities on the foreign fighters that are coming for very sound legal reasons. But Turks are now reportedly more worried about the jihadist threat to Turkey. So this is, according to people we've talked to, been getting better of late. But as we've seen, there are still big differences between Turkey and the counter-ISIL coalition writ large on Syria. And those differences, I think it's safe to say, mean that it's still probably continue to inhibit cooperation on foreign fighters. The third stage is the training and fighting stage, when the foreign fighters are actually in theater. And they there are, of course, mostly out of reach of U.S. or European influence, but I think there are actually still subtle ways of influencing the terrorist production function in theater. Sowing doubts about the true loyalties of Western foreign fighters and playing on their ties to Western culture is often very effective. Of course, this has to be done somewhat quietly, but I suspect it is already being done. If the jihadist groups come to view foreigners as potential spies, they will assign them to non-combat roles, give them the one-way ticket of suicide bombing, or even avoid recruiting them in the first place. And they will do similar things if they come to view the foreign fighters as a corrupting influence. The next stage is the return to their home country. And this is probably the most important stage, actually, from a policy standpoint. And it's the one in which we thought many Western governments are not doing as well as they could. As Dan mentioned, the information on return is fairly good. Western security services tend to know when these people come back. But at that point, what do you do when you know that a foreign fighter is returning? Our view is that there needs to be an element of triage here. You have to look at the people coming back and assess who are the real hard cases, who might move forward to attack and who will never really reintegrate fully into the society. Who are the people who are at least ready or able to reintegrate and who can be moved away from jihad? And who are the people who aren't really interested in it at all? Many of them will have some form of PTSD and will benefit from some forms of counseling. When you look at the numbers, it seems that many or most people can really be turned away from further violence at this point. While at the same time, hounding them with judicial processes or adding to their sense of alienation when they return to the society, failing to reintegrate them can actually push them over toward violence. And family and community members have often succeeded at this stage in calming down, if you will, foreign fighters who return. They've done better at this stage, I think, than at the decision stage. Particularly effective, it turns out, is getting them married. So I'm not sure if dating services are appropriate, but it is effective. In this regard, jail turns out to be a real problem. I think it's the natural inclination of governments to say, well, these people went abroad to fight for a foreign terrorist organization. We're going to put them in jail. That's illegal, which it is in most Western countries. But actually, jail is arguably a more effective radicalizer than fighting in a foreign conflict. And the crime for the punishment for a crime such as fighting for a terrorist organization can never be that great. So these people will eventually, and actually reasonably quickly, be released. When they are, they could be more dangerous than when they went in. So if you're thinking about it from a long-term perspective, I think you have to be very careful with jail. There's considerable variation on this, we saw in our research across the Western countries. The French have a very strong blanket policy of arresting people. They arrested two French teenagers who came back after they were just there for 3 weeks and became very disillusioned. They were only 15 and 16 years old when they went. And the French interior minister simply said, that's our policy. We arrest them. They've committed an illegal act. Whereas the Danish have an entire system in place to evaluate people for risk and take more varied action, although one has to admit that that's because their laws don't so easily allow for arrest. But I think the broader problem is that politically it's a lot easier to arrest somebody than it is to try to reintegrate them. The general public gets very angry that people could get benefits for doing this thing, and the punishment for failure, for triaging incorrectly, is very severe. This is, as one security official told us, this is how directors get fired. If you put somebody through a reintegration program and he later moves to an attack, which is always possible, then there is a lot of recrimination against the security services. And all of those are very strong political realities. But we should recognize that the research, I think, shows that this will increase the likelihood of violence, not decrease it. The final stage is the plotting stage. This is, I think, primarily a question of security services focus and, as Dan indicated, resources. Information is fairly good, in part because of social media. But the increased numbers of people returning from Syria and Iraq have created real strains on a lot of the security services for keeping track of suspects. The Australian security services recently estimated that to monitor a single individual on a sort of full-time basis for a year will cost them $7 million. So you don't have that math adds up pretty quickly. And as we've seen, the price of failure on this is very, very high for the security services as well. So they're caught in this sort of resource trap. There's been some success in some countries at spreading around the burden of responsibility as this problem gets bigger to local police and other forms of community law enforcement. And this implies that the key at this stage right now might be cooperation between services rather than, as a lot of Western countries have tended to do, to put all of the burden on the intelligence domestic security services, but rather to broaden it out to local services. It also implies that cooperation between services, especially in Europe, is very important. A lot of the European countries have this sort of border problem where the border is open to potential terrorists traveling across it, but it's not open to security services, and this creates a gap in their monitoring, which we've seen play a role in the one Syrian foreign fighter attack we've seen in Brussels. So in sum, I think that there's a lot that can be done and that is being done for this problem to reduce the threat of foreign fighters. It doesn't present an existential challenge to the West. But as Dan said, it's almost inevitable that there will be some terrorist attacks carried out by returnees from Syria or Iraq. Terrorism, unfortunately, has become a feature of modern life. And like crime, it can only be controlled, not eradicated. And it seems certain that the fallout of the wars in Syria and Iraq will make that problem somewhat more difficult. But it is important not to overreact or to panic, to recognize that both the U.S. and Europe have dealt with this problem before and already have effective measures in place to reduce the threat and to limit the scale of any attacks that might occur. These measures can be improved. They can be more adequately resourced. But the standard of success cannot be perfection. If it is, we're doomed to failure. And worse, we're prone to overreaction, which will waste resources and probably cause dangerous policy failures. This is a somewhat difficult message to deliver, I think, in the wake of the recent attacks in Paris. The mind definitely reels at the horror of an attack like that, and the urge to do something to respond forcefully is very strong. But as the strong societal reaction in France shows, such terrorists can commit violence against individuals, but they can't really threaten the society. It's unclear at this point how, if at all, these attacks relate to foreign fighters. But we know as a generalized rule that immediately after an outrage like this, we tend to have certain reactions which don't help the policy response. First, we tend to overestimate the degree of central coordination and the degree of influence from abroad. Second, we tend to blame the security services for failures by using a sort of retrospective analysis, whereby you sort of go back and see where a particular policy intervention could have prevented the attack without recognizing that in the general universe of things, that would have been a very difficult policy intervention to have. And finally, we tend to put in place measures that, while they reassure us in the short term, do more to cause long-term alienation in target populations than to prevent terrorism. And they've also failed to create the sense of resilience in the society, which you really need to deal with a problem that can't be eliminated. These mistakes are very hard to avoid because they respond to the politics of the moment. And we can have, I think, in this country, a lot of sympathy for those types of mistakes. And in fact, France, which I've been studying in terms of counterterrorism for a long time, has a mixed but largely good record on this. They have a very long arc of responding to terrorism, responding to terrorism from the Middle East and from the Islamic world, which began in the 1960s. And their response to the threat of Algerian in terrorism in the 1960s and 70s does have all the sort of hallmarks of the type of overreaction that I'm talking about. But they largely fixed this in the 1990s and created a system which was actually quite good at recognizing the threats that were most dangerous and preventing the types of overreactions that I'm talking about. But it seems very clear that in France of 2015, the politics of integration are going to make this a lot harder, and that the tensions that exist in France which have been growing significantly over the last 10 or 20 years between the Muslim populations and certain segments of the French political spectrum mean that these measures are going to become instrumentalized in an effort in the integration fights in France, which are much more about French culture and French politics than they are about terrorism. But terrorism becomes an important symbol. So I think that's what we have to watch out for, and that's what hopefully the French will manage to deal with. And I think that to the extent that we can come up with policy recommendations that French politicians can take, which can reduce the threat of terrorism, which can help reassure their populations, but which don't have these alienating effects, we will have done them probably one of the biggest benefits we can do in terms of solidarity. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dan Benjamin.
Well, thank you very much. It's wonderful to be back at Brookings, where I spent some of the happiest years of my career. And I particularly want to thank you for inviting me down to Washington to enjoy some of your lousy weather. I think that this is a very strong paper, a very strong presentation, and lives up to my expectations of my two friends and colleagues. I think there are a lot of wise policy proposals in it. I'm in broad agreement on the assertion that the foreign fighter threat, at least as it's been represented in the press and to some extent by official spokesmen, has to some extent been overstated. And certainly the empirical record of the last 15 years or so suggests that there is some fighting of not just the last war, but the one before that, the jihad in Afghanistan in the 1980s, where returnees did play such an important role in creating the Al-Qaeda network and in fomenting unrest at home. I think it is true that Europe in particular, the United States to a lesser extent, is going to struggle with a foreign fighter problem for some years to come because of large numbers of people who have gone to fight in Iraq and in Syria. But at the same time, I want to agree with the authors for their assertion that that in our intelligence capabilities are significantly better, not least because we're awake to the problem, as we weren't in the 1980s and early 90s, and that this makes a world of difference. I think they also make a very good point that we assume a little too glibly, I think, that the tools that the foreign fighters acquire, the skills that they acquire in the theater necessarily translate into good terrorism skills. A lot of these folks are fighting in an insurgency. They're fighting irregular warfare. They're not learning how to carry out clandestine operations in the West, and that is something that should be kept in mind. I do think one of the worrisome things, just to jump ahead a bit, about the Paris attack was the reliance on assault weapons and rocket launchers, because that suggests a change in tactics. And I'm not saying that they were foreign fighters, but those are tactics that foreign fighters might plausibly use. And if there are so many weapons available in Europe that kind of attack is planned more often, then we will indeed face a significant challenge there. I also agree that the public discussion of the threat from foreign fighters has, I think, been rather undifferentiating in not understanding what it is that's going on in Iraq and Syria, the distinctively sectarian nature of the conflict there, the way, as our moderator Will McCants has written, that this plays into some of the apocalyptic thinking that is going on in some Muslim communities now, and how detached it is from the belief that there is an ineluctable war against the infidel West, as bin Laden would put it. So I don't think there's an automaticity here about coming back and carrying out terrorist attacks. One of the things that I particularly like about the paper, and this is the kind of pleasure that you can have when you're out of government because you can't think about this when you're in government, is the sly questioning of whether we wouldn't be better off letting more people go to the war zone where they might meet a more useful end than if they're left in their home countries and bottle up their frustrations, their angers, live out things vicariously, and then carry out attacks. And that, in the wake of the Paris tragedies, is something that perhaps ought to be a little more debated in the public. I have to say, from a former policymaker's perspective, I'm not too optimistic that we're going to stop the big sprint to deal with the foreign fighters problem in the way that we have, because policymakers have to throw themselves against the sort of public understanding of the threat and can't make those kinds of distinctions and gamble, essentially make a bet that if they go there, they won't come back. There was a brief moment, it's interesting to note, and during the early days of the Iraq War, where the Bush administration was making what came to be called the flypaper theory, that if all the bad guys went there, they'd all get killed there. So, you know, it's a complicated issue. It's not one that admits of an easy solution. But it's not entirely clear to me that all the measures we're taking to prevent foreign fighters will ultimately redound to our benefit. Let me just make a few other observations regarding the paper, but particularly in light of what we have seen in the last few days and the tragedies in Paris. I think one of the messages here, if I can go off script a little and talk about that, one of the messages here is that we're at what appears to be a catalytic moment in terms of radical extremism, radical Islamism in Europe. And there's no doubt that the ISIS effect is an important part of it. And that, by the ISIS effect, I mean that the perception that there is now a radical Islamist operation going on in the Middle East that is resulting to capture and holding of territory, the creation of a proto-state or pseudo-state, and the effort to create a government under some version of Sharia law is having a galvanizing effect on extremists, particularly in Europe. Combining that and creating a kind of perfect storm situation is anti-immigrant sentiment in Europe, which is highly inflamed. You only need to look at the success of UKIP, the rise of Pegida, the rise of the national, or the I shouldn't say the rise, but the strong support for the National Front right now. All of that is poisoning community relations in Europe. And intimately tied up with that is the persistent economic downturn, which creates xenophobia and, in this case, in these particular circumstances, more Islamophobia. And that leads, I think, provisionally, I'll suggest, to some policy recommendations. One is that I do think we need to continue to focus on denting ISIS in the region that it is operating. Having said that, I think that the remarks from one of the conspirators in Paris that he was radicalized by Abu Ghraib reminds us quite clearly of the perils of intervention. And both authors talked about how intervention is going to have an effect and redirect some of the energies of these extremists towards us. So I think that the administration has the right idea in terms of building a coalition and having people who live in the neighborhood, countries that live in the neighborhood, take care of this issue. It's not going to be taken care of overnight. It's going to take quite some time. But the perception that it is a failing venture, I think, will have a deflating effect over the long term on extremists in Europe. And that's why it's important. And here I'm making a bit of an about face because my view at the beginning was that we were overheated about ISIS. I still think that's true to a certain extent, but I think we need to recognize that there are those connections. Similarly, or I should say to buttress that argument, I'll just say if you look at what's happened in Sydney and in Ottawa and previously in other recent terrorist attacks of note, it's clear that the primary threat of the moment, to my mind, is individuals who want to act out, who want to carry out a violent attack in some way to show their support, their participation in the broader global struggle, where the focus may be in the Middle East, but their view is that they have a role to play at home as well. We don't know very much yet about the perpetrators in this particular case, but I would say it's a decent hypothesis that we'll find out that they too, in some ways, were hoping to immortalize themselves in that way. And I certainly agree with Jeremy's statement about our tendency to think that there is more command and control here than is often the case, or at least that's been the record. So that leads me to a final recommendation, which is that we really do need to think about what the ways of dealing with extremism, particularly in Europe, and it's particularly a European problem, what the ways of dealing with that extremism are that are actually not focused on people coming and going to these regions, but actually diminishing the hold that extremism has on members within these communities. And we should remember that these are very, very small numbers within communities that are by and large very loyal, very patriotic, and eager to integrate. I think that the remarks about resources for security services are very well put. That it has not been a great area of performance by our European partners in recent years. And similarly, there's been a lot of politicization and unwillingness to continue experiments on countering violent extremism at home. There is, you know, a well-trod bureaucratic tendency to deal with the most immediate kinetic threats, and foreign fighters will fill that bill without doing the long, hard work of integrating communities, providing more opportunity, trying to create jobs for immigrants and the like. Governments tend not to be hugely trusting of social science and these long-term efforts that will pay off when someone else is in office many years down the line. But I think that it's quite clear that this is an urgent requirement right now. I want to applaud the White House for calling a big CVE conference, and I hope that the resources will follow that kind of emphasis both at home and abroad. And with that, let me again commend the authors on a very good paper, a good corrective, I think, to some misplaced emphases in the public debate, and say that I think this is a conversation we need to continue having.
Okay, thank you, Ambassador Benjamin, Dan, Jeremy. Before I throw it open to audience questions, I had three quick questions of my own. I'm going to ask them in succession to give the speakers a little bit of time to think about it. But the first one's going to go to Dan Benjamin, and it's to pick up on a point you briefly alluded to, but I'd like you to tease it out a little bit. The argument that Dan and Jeremy have made is that we just don't see a lot of blowback in Europe from foreign fighters going to travel abroad. But I wonder, particularly in light of the recent Paris attacks, if there is a shift in tactics away from the love affair for the infernal machine or the bomb and more for gathering small arms and going on a shooting spree, if that might change the dynamic somewhat and we might see an uptick simply because it's easier to pull off an attack like that than it is to build a bomb. One, because it's hard to build a bomb, but two, all the logistics involved makes it easier for you to appear on some security services radar. The second question is for Dan Byman, and it's about the threat represented by the Syrian conflict, not so much the foreign fighters coming back, at least directly, but the fact that there are so many folks going abroad and coming back that it overwhelms the security services. And they're not able to keep track of the guys they've already been watching, like this network we've been looking at for the past few days that hasn't gone abroad, but was deemed to be, I would guess, a lesser threat compared to some of the foreign fighters coming back. So I wonder what your assessment is of the how overwhelmed the security services are in Europe right now because of Syria. And then the final question is for Jeremy Shapiro. It's about the CVE summit that's coming up in February, being sponsored by the White House. You seem to be pessimistic about certain kinds of interventions, particularly on your five-tiered model at the decision point, trying to dissuade people who have already expressed a strong desire to travel abroad, to support a terrorist group, but haven't actually gone abroad or committed any criminal behavior. Some have suggested, myself included, that it might be a good idea to have some sort of program to try and talk these folks out of it, bringing in the community, their families, so on and so forth. But from your research, it sounds like you're a little bit pessimistic about the efficacy of those sort of interventions. So I wonder if you could talk about it in the context of this CVE summit coming up. So, Dan, back to you.
Sure, Will. Thanks for the question. So historically, terrorist groups, jihadist groups, have shunned weapons, you know, weapons attacks, long arms, assault rifles. I guess the exceptions here would be Mumbai, where you had, you know, practically a running street battle for multiple days. And then I think you have to go all the way back probably to Luxor and the Gamal Islamiyah attack in 1995. And the explanation here generally is that Al-Qaeda and its offshoots thought you needed to have a big bang to have meaningful violence, and that repetitive explosions in particular would have a paralyzing effect on targeted societies. The use of these kinds of weapons in Paris, I mean, I'm hypothesizing again here, but I'm, you know, I think there are a lot more weapons out there than there were 10 or 12 years ago due to the vast amounts of armaments that went lost in Libya after the fall of Gaddafi, and the very, very large amounts that came out of Iraqi stocks at various points along the way and out of Syrian stockpiles. And combining with that, you have the growing call for individual jihad, which really, you know, the key progenitor of that idea was Anwar al-Awlaki. And I think that that continues to reverberate in extremist communities and gives, you know, self-starters a chance to, shall we say, you know, get the means of production into their hands faster and not spend enormous amounts of time grinding explosives, buying fertilizer, which is hard to find now, or the different kinds of chemicals that are carefully being tracked by law enforcement. So this could be, you know, a dangerous new trend, and every time you have an attack like this, it legitimizes that kind of weaponry, that kind of attack, and nothing we've seen in the Twitter sphere suggests to me yet that there is any moving away from that. And I think this will be a challenge for law enforcement. We've seen it at home as well. You know, the most fatal, the most impactful attack in the United States was Nidal Hassan at Fort Hood in recent years. And so, you know, I think it is something to be concerned about.
Dan Byman?
Will asked about the security services being overwhelmed, and this is a tremendous issue. As Jeremy mentioned, the cost of following an individual is staggering. The personnel required to follow an individual is a huge number. And so there's no question that given the large numbers who have gone to Syria and Iraq, many security services will have problems. I would highlight two things to think about when judging how serious the problem is. An obvious question is, you know, how many people from that country are going, right? And you have a lot of variation within this in Europe. Perhaps surprisingly, Belgium has an extremely large number of people who have gone. The other question is the skill and experience of the security services. So countries like Denmark, the United Kingdom, France have dealt with jihadist-linked terrorism for quite some time. And they have networks, they have experience, they have skilled personnel. Other countries, I seem to be picking on Belgium for no reason, but Belgium have not, fortunately for them, had this experience, but it means they're starting from scratch. So you're more likely to see problems and mistakes from these sorts of countries. As Jeremy mentioned, they're all going to need to triage. That's what you do when you have limited resources, is you have to make judgments about who is the most dangerous. But when you triage, you will make mistakes. There'll be people you think are dangerous who are not, and conversely, others who are off the radar screen who turn out to be dangerous. American help can be extremely valuable here. I would simply remind our European friends that the National Security Agency is extremely competent, and they might want to encourage NSA to pay attention to some of these issues, and I think would be an extremely valuable addition to their own counterterrorism capabilities. I will also urge a sense of resilience. If you go back to the 2005 terrorist attacks in London, you had a parliamentary inquiry that said the key person behind it was on the radar screen of security services. They took him off the radar screen because they judged that other people were more of a threat. In other words, they triaged. That was okay. Their conclusion was, given what they knew at the time, that was a reasonable judgment. Politically, I couldn't imagine doing that in the United States. right, that, you know, let's say the FBI had been tracking one of the 9/11 suspects actively, closely, carefully, and said, yeah, we're not going to bother with this person. Right? That would have been politically a disaster. So I urge us to be able to have that ability to understand what the security services must do, which is triage, and when problems happen, recognize that. The sense of resilience to me is tremendously important. In the United States, for some reason I still don't understand, we seem to accept that there will be a school shooting on a fairly regular basis, and that's part of the price of living in America. Yet for terrorism to me, which is something that's in some ways a more difficult issue, we're utterly unwilling to accept a very, very low number of casualties for terrorism, and we want to try to stop every attack, let's be clear. But we can't allow terrorists to claim victory if one attack happens.
Thanks, Will. So the question of this global security summit, I should be a little bit circumspect since I have no idea what it's about, but I don't imagine anybody does. But, you know, I can take some guesses. And I guess I am quite pessimistic about the government's ability to really interfere in the individual's decision to go join jihad. I think that that's fundamentally because although we like to sort of attribute this to broad social causes, integration and jihad, in fact, to me, and a lot of the research indicates this, this is in fact a very small numbers phenomenon which has to do fundamentally with the sort of 17 to 26-year-old male who is making a decision which is based really on a more on a sort of thirst for personal adventure and a sort of adolescent psychology than on social causes. And that is, you know, pretty much a constant in history, the sort of young man hooking up with whatever radical ideology is out there and taking it to violent extremes is a near constant. It has different manifestations in different eras, and it seems as if the psychology that would have made somebody in the 1930s go to fight in the Spanish Civil War, the psychology that would have made somebody join a leftist terrorist organization in the 1960s and 70s, and the psychology that makes somebody join a jihadist group in the 2010s are roughly similar, although they operate within different milieu. And of course, most people under any circumstances do not make this decision. It is a radical fringe who tends to have other personal or even psychological issues. We keep saying that the numbers of foreign fighters are large, and they are relative to past experience, but relative to the population, even of young males or even of young Islamic males, they are not large. In fact, this is a very small number of people who make these decisions. And while the idea that France or lots of other parts of Europe have Muslim integration problems, which it would make a lot of sense to address for any number of reasons, including just having a population which is alienated and which is suffering from discrimination and from economic deprivation, is not a good idea for any society at any point. The linkage between this and the terrorism problem is very difficult to discern. And I think we've seen that a lot of efforts on this front, particularly in Europe, but also here, and very little evidence that it's made much difference. The PREVENT program in the UK, which is a strong effort to do this, broadly concluded of itself that it had not really succeeded. That in fact they couldn't really point to any instance where they had actually turned someone away from extremism. And that's kind of a damning indictment because we've been doing this for a long time. Having said that, I mean, I'm glad that they're having a global security summit, and I'm even glad that they're discussing it in these terms rather than in the sort of pure kinetic terms. But I would like I would like, when they approach that summit, for them to do a couple of things, to have a couple of principles foremost in mind. One is this sort of small numbers phenomenon, which is that this is generally not about the communities, it's about individuals. And the second thing is the sort of limited capacity of governments, just by the nature of what governments are, to actually have theological or ideological disputes with teenagers in a way which is productive for either side. And that the real actors in this struggle have to be the communities. And that they are actors in this struggle, and they do probably as well or better than the government could ever do. There's certain things that the government can do to assist them, but there again, it has to play a very secondary role, and governments are not very good at sort of saying, in the first instance, they say, well, governments don't do this well, so the community has to do it. And then the second question that the policymaker asks himself is, okay, how can I make the community do this? And actually, it has to be a little bit more organic than that, which is, I think, a little bit difficult for governments to get a hold of.
Very much. We'll open it up for questions from the audience.
Thanks very much. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report. And I want to pose a question that I think speaks to something that Jeremy Shapiro just touched on, but which Dan and Jeremy do in that five-step process. And it is, I've been thinking about a parallel and wondering if there is one, which is whether there is a parallel in that five-step process of intervention possibilities that would mirror the broken windows theory of policing, which, granted, is got, I don't know if it's got a black eye right now, but it's under some question. But in other words, that the broken windows theory is the notion that the earlier you enter the process, and now we're talking about crime per se, the greater the likelihood that you can prevent the stuff that's much further up the food chain. And I wondered whether in your research and your thinking about this, whether you think there's a parallel there or whether that's just not the case. And a second, if I might, and perhaps it's something Dan Benjamin could speak to, in this conversation you haven't touched on the tool that is capturing a lot of attention these days, and that's hacking, and the capacity for those who have read David Ignatius's latest novel to get some idea of just how impactful hacking can be, and how it counters to some extent the notion that small acts by individuals can't affect the state. There's reason to believe that may not be the case. Let me leave it at that.
I'll begin on broken windows. Yes and no. I mean, in general, with any intervention, if you could do it earlier, the better thing, right? You're stopping a young person from possibly throwing away his life, from possibly taking others down with him. So that's always a good thing. But as Jeremy mentioned, many of our tools for this are quite limited. So the question of, you know, how do you reach out to that 17-year-old who's excited and angry and inspired by friends and often makes a decision in a relatively short period of time, right, where they go from saying, you know, I'm just a guy who likes to hang out with my friends and play Xbox, to I want to be a fighter and I'm hopping on an airplane. Right, I have the misfortune of being a parent of teenagers, and I know that their minds can change in often quite destructive directions in a remarkably short period of time. So I do think you do want to invest in these programs that help communities build structures, as Jeremy mentioned, but at the same time, I wouldn't count on them to be able to solve this problem in a deeper sense.
Benjamin, you want to say anything about the online world and radicalization, I mean, particularly in contrast to the kind of
radicalization problem you were dealing with in the 80s and 90s. It is quite different today.
I think you're more qualified to talk about it than I am. You actually go online. So the short answer is I actually don't have a lot to add on that, and I think Will is a better source. And I'm not quite sure what you mean by hacking in this context. There's a flourishing internet milieu of extremism. I think that this we learn an enormous amount from watching it. We occasionally intervene in it, as we did do with the operations based in the State Department at the Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications. It's a good place to mix up the arguments, throw the extremists off balance. And, as with all these things, you have to sort of do the gain loss and figure out how much is it worth. The whole issue of computer generated radicalization remains a vexed one. And I think Will probably would have more to say about it. I continue to think that, we may get the occasional lone wolf out of it. It's not the only problem out there. I do also want to just respond a little to what Jeremy said on working with community CVE, economic conditions. Jeremy and I have worked together for many years, and we've been having this argument for many years. It's not angry adolescents from Malibu who are going off to Syria and Iraq because they don't have any connection with that, and they find other ways to do unwise things, whether it's rock climbing or any number of other activities that I wouldn't be caught dead doing. There is, it is true that these kinds of broad social interventions are quite challenging, that they take a long time. But I think it's still true in Europe, where we've seen just so much evidence of discrimination against Muslims, and so much countervailing demonstrations of Muslim desire for deeper integration, that this has to be a continuing grievance that needs addressing. I don't think that we're going to solve it very quickly, but these are deeply disturbing sort of bedrock issues there. And I feel like we, at our peril, overlook them. And many of these, young people are the victims of really poor education systems that have left them with no perspectives whatsoever, with the kind of dead-end lives that they have in the banlieue. You could go on from there and there. And I think that the fate of some of these programs, Jeremy mentioned Prevent, I think has less to do with the results they were showing, they weren't really around for very long, than with the kind of cultural interpretations that were being made of them and the kind of encouragement of a wide-ranging multiculturalism, having interlocutors who are Salafis, who have very different ideas of what they want out of their state and what their relationship is with it. We have very low tolerance for innovation in this area, and our European friends have even less, it seems to me. So I think that it's just self-evident that yes, these are goods in their own right, but also it's important to recognize. Olivier Waugh, who's a good friend of Brookings, has said here that sometimes radicalism is not the result of a rejection of the host society, but a frustrated integration, and I think that's something that we need to think harder about.
Right, let me get three questions here first.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you very much. My name is Daniel Ginsberg. I'm a graduate student at the American University, and my question is regarding policy. In regards to individuals who may be a threat as returning fighters, would it be prudent for Western governments to take away their passports when they're leaving, or should they perform similar to Tunisia has and allow them to export the foreign fighters and prevent them from coming back later? I ask because of the events in Ottawa recently this summer in which an individual was prevented from leaving the country and he went on to a shooting spree in the parliament. As you will.
Thank you. All right, let me get two more. Yes, ma'am, here.
Thanks for your presentation. I just always think, what's the real cause? Why terrorists or other nation or other race, they don't like America the way America is doing things, in even they see in the United States or overseas? I think, you know, a lot of politicians, law enforcement, a lot of abuse, and they don't even really want to recognize that. They just cover up. So I just wonder, by all means, from any literature that you know, or your own study, or in your own observation, why other people, other races, including terrorists, how do they influence by their supervisors or by their mentors? Why they don't like America? Why America doing things wrong? They convince them to be a terrorist. That we label them that way, but we don't label them ourselves, our officials, or terrorists in our own country. Now, we have a lot of people suffer and die by all means, whether by gunshot or by medication or by injection or by hunger. So I just wonder, what's the difference? They do things away from what we do things, and what we do things is very wrong. Can we change the policy? We do things ourselves first and treat them nicely.
Thank you, ma'am. Okay, in the back, brown jacket, or in the middle, I guess, yeah.
Hi, I'm Philippe Lecour. I'm a visiting fellow with the CUSE here at Brookings. Just a couple of points on what Jeremy has said. I agree on the integration issue. I'm French, by the way. France has been working on this for many years. I think we've reached really a critical point now where people get hold of weapons that were not in the Schengen area until a few years ago, and especially getting trained in the way they were in Paris last week. And by the way, we've discussed this with Jeremy, but the foreign fighters means also people having foreign passports, and in Europe, sometimes it does. But we're talking here about people who had EU passports, so much more difficult to handle than you know, if they were foreigners. Now, I have two specific questions for both Daniels, and sorry, they're a bit controversial. One of them is, one is a quick one, really, on the NSA. If the NSA is so good and has been so helpful in Europe, why didn't they come up with some better suggestions in the past few months and years on the issue we've been discussing? Foreign fighters and, you know, this kind of thing.
I didn't know it didn't.
And secondly, Daniel was saying that, you know, we should give a phone call to the NSA, or maybe that's what will happen in February. And secondly, a broader question perhaps on foreign policy decisions that have been made by the West and by the US in particular for the past, 10, 15 years. This is a global question. What is the impact of such decisions, such as invading Iraq 10 years ago or a bit more, or in the case of Europe mainly, invading Libya? And how does the impact these foreign fighters?
Thank you very much. So we've got two questions on U.S. foreign policy, fundamental driver of terrorism, why do they hate us sort of thing. We've got one on, is the NSA really that good? And then we've got a policy question on whether or not passports should be taken away. So anyone want to raise their hand first?
I'll do NSA as it was directed to me. Is the NSA that good? Yeah, sure. If you look at the revelations that came out in the Snowden files, what upset people was how good the NSA was. right? It wasn't a case of incompetence and these people don't know what they're doing and they're wasting money. It was, oh my goodness, I did not realize they could do this, right? I did not realize how extensive their capacity was. And in a strange way, I always felt bad for NSA, where I thought they were being punished for doing what the president told them, for telling Congress they were doing it, and then getting court approval. And therefore, there was a scandal for some reason I could never quite figure out. And they were actually quite remarkable in their capacity. And if you look at what we're talking about in Europe, I obviously do not know any of the specific intelligence as it relates to these individuals. To be clear, what I saw is simply from, the New York Times. But these individuals were tracked, according to the New York Times, by American intelligence going to Yemen. And then it was passed off to French domestic services. Right now, there are plenty of ways you can gather intelligence outside signals intelligence, but for travel, signals intelligence is very good. If you want social media coverage, that's signals intelligence. And as social media, as communication has expanded dramatically in the last 20 years, where the volume is staggering, the overwhelming majority of that has been in the realm of signals intelligence. So if you want to track this sort of thing, you're talking about NSA. Now, it's perfectly reasonable to say we actually want to take more risk and want more restrictions on this. That's a reasonable balance, but you need to recognize you're taking more risk. It's not simply a statement of saying, oh, these guys have nothing to offer. They have a tremendous amount to offer, and you can refuse it. And that's reasonable at times. I think you should. But to do so, it's not cost-free.
Sure. Let me pile on here. I think Dan's exactly right on the NSA, and I think that the long-term direction post-Paris will be for ever closer intelligence cooperation and exchange. I think that's a great way to decrease overall costs. The numbers that you see about how much it costs to cover someone 24/7 are extremely high, and good signals intelligence reduces those costs dramatically. And, I think that there's going to be an interesting doctoral dissertation somewhere in the future on the surveillance debate and how it was affected by terrorist attack. They do a superb job. And actually, it's kind of interesting that the French reaction to the NSA debate, by and large, was, who cares? It was much more overheated. I remember much more heated in Germany and to some extent in the UK. The extent to which counterterrorism success depends on international partnerships can't be overstated. And we go through cycles in history, and I think that there may have been some diminution in vigilance as we went through a pretty quiet period between 2009, 2012, and now I think we'll see a lot more and deeper engagement. There was plenty of engagement before, and it's going to continue to build in the years ahead, and I think it's good for transatlantic relations and good for safety and security.
And how about the passport question, since you worked at the State Department? Does that make good policy sense for the United States?
I think it's actually a constitutional problem for the United States. And I also think that this is a great case where you really need great signals intelligence and cooperation with other intelligence services to know who's moving where.
Okay, thank you. Jeremy, you have anything to add?
Sure, I'll try to deal with the foreign policy. I think it is a sort of vexed one and a frustrating one. I think everybody wants to see the threat of terrorism as contributing to their foreign policy preference. But I think the relationship is very confused and very complicated. It's interesting, for example, when we were doing this research, it was before the United States had really gotten involved in Syria. And so we were constantly asking, does it matter that for this foreign conflict that the United States is not involved? Does it matter to the threat of terrorism? Does it matter that your country, when we were in other countries, is not involved? And by and large, the answer was no. We had expected it to be yes, but there was a sort of elaborate way in which the sort of meta-narrative of the sort of global struggle of jihad versus the West had overtaken specific foreign policy decisions. And maybe if we reached back 40 years, we could have undone that. But that's over. And there was this sort of general view that there was this, amongst these youth, that there was this vague struggle out there. And so it was hard to connect it to particular foreign policy decisions. I think there's a bigger principle at stake, of course, too, which is that you don't want your foreign policy determined by terrorist attacks. And, you know, if it's a good idea to invade Libya or Iraq, then it's a good idea to do it even if terrorists don't want you to. I personally didn't think it was a good idea to do those things, but that wouldn't have been the reason. So I think having said all of that, I think, you know, we should have a good foreign policy. And a lot of our foreign policies have not contributed to the solutions to these problems, and in a way which is simply gratuitous. And so I'm not saying that we shouldn't consider this problem consider foreign policy decisions in the light of this problem. But I would be loath to think that we could, even if we wanted to, appease these people, because what's very clear in the ideology is that what they're deeply offended by, the most radical extreme versions, is kind of who we are. It's this sort of globalization phenomenon, which is certainly most sharply represented by military intervention, but which is rather essentially an effect of the modern world, which we couldn't stop ourselves from doing even if we tried.
Get three more questions from the audience. Fellow in the second row here. Third row, yeah.
Wait,
let's get the mic.
My name is Avi. I recently visited here a very distinguished person from one of the countries in EU. He's the head of the intelligence community of his country. This is what he said. They have some hundreds of foreigner fighters that left the country to fight in Syria and Iraq. None of them are 15 or 14 or 16 years old. Most of them are fourth generation. The second issue, most of them are well educated. They graduated universities. Some of them, they have PhD. And they are not coming from poor families. They have money, fourth generations, and well educated. My question is, don't you think that you missed the point that the issue is changed recently? You call them ISIS or ISIL, but they don't call themselves anymore ISIS or ISIS. They call themselves IS. It's not only in Syria and Iraq, in the Levant and Sham. It's IS all over the world. So they are here. They don't have passports. They didn't leave the country. They didn't leave Canada. They didn't leave EU. They are not the foreign fighters. There are many that hold the ideology, and they're not coming from poor families. So do you think that maybe you mitigate the problem by talking about the poor and the young and the teenagers, and there are not many? Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Yes, down here in front. Wait for the mic.
Hi, I'm Gary O'Donoghue. I'm just arrived as the new Washington correspondent for the BBC. I have a question for the ambassador, which is that talking about the capacity of security services to follow, in the UK's case, up to hundreds, up to 500 people who have possibly travelled to Syria, follow them when they come home, or at least the ones that don't expire while they're out there. What do you think about one proposal or one plan that's going through Parliament at the moment in London, which is what's called temporary exclusion orders? In other words, not taking people's passports off them while they're at home, but preventing them from coming back. So they have to wander the world for a couple of years while you work out whether or not they're going to be a danger.
Thank you. We'll take one more question. All the way in the back.
Thank you. Tolga Tan is with you yet. I had a quick question regarding recruitment process, actually. When we look at the case in Paris, one of the perpetrators was associated with AQAP. The sheriff, Kouachi, said that he was with AQAP and he was financed by the Emir al-Awlaki. And the other one, Amedi Koulibaly, said that he was associated with ISIS. So given the clashes between the two groups in Syria, how the recruitment process is going on abroad for the foreign fighters in foreign countries? I mean, are they working together? Are they common pipelines? Or can you elaborate a little bit on this?
Okay, thank you. So we've got two questions of a similar nature about the spread of Islamic State fandom. We know that the Islamic State is at odds with al-Qaeda, but it seems at some level among some of the foot soldiers there's some coordination, so somebody on the panel could address that. And then, Dan, a question specifically to you about another policy question of stopping short of revoking passports fully, perhaps suspending them and not allowing people to come back home but to hang out in airport lounges forever. So who wants to take the Islamic State fandom question.
I'll take that.
Sure.
When I said in my remarks, I will underscore again here. I think that what we're seeing is a general level of heat in the environment, of excitation, of real fascination with what is going on in Syria and Iraq and with ISIS. Such that people who have affiliations across the jihadist spectrum feel a need to act out or a desire to act out and be part of this bigger picture. In theater, ISIS and al-Qaeda-related groups are killing each other. The fact that you could have Koulibaly and the Kouachis coordinating, you know, having 500 phone calls between them, I think is a real testament to this broader sense that this is the moment to act, that it's a moment of crystallization, as the sociologists would say. And those allegiances are thin in terms of their actual material. Who knows if Koulibaly ever talked to someone who was really in ISIS. So, again, we still have a lot to learn about command and control and AQAP. I come back to it. I don't think we should get, in the case of Europe in particular right now, and those who are carrying out terrorist attacks there, I don't think we should think that the these declarations of allegiance declarations of, you know, group relationships are the most important aspects coming out of this chapter, and I think a lot of it is about extremism in general.
Andrew Jeremy?
Just to sort of add to what Dan says in the specific research that we did, it was the recruitment for Syria, such as it was, turned out to be very different than it had been in previous examples. And a lot of that had to do with the sort of, first with the ease of travel, but also with the internet. In previous examples, there had been these networks. Intriguingly, one of the attackers in Paris was associated with one of these networks, attack case, that essentially funneled people to certain groups in the foreign land. And we saw that in Somalia, too, from the United States, even. In the Syria case, that doesn't really seem to be happening. It seems in large part because it's not necessary. The people are sort of radicalized and sort of semi-recruited on the internet, and basically what they're told is show up at this hotel. They don't even really, they tend not to know which group they're joining. They know it's a sort of vaguely jihadist group. And so they just make their way
all the way to the Turkish-Syrian border without really much organization at all. And that's a more difficult problem, I think, because it means you can't really break up one of these groups like the French did in 2005 to prevent the flow. It also means, though, that the attachment between the group and the recruiting back home is very, very loose. It's essentially just propaganda, and they actually do the individual recruiting more or less on the ground. So I don't think there is a common pipeline. There almost is no pipeline at all. In terms of the question that you asked about the temporary exclusion orders, I know it was asked to Dan Benjamin, but we have practically the same mind. So I'll address it.
I'll comment on that afterward. There's some bugs in the software. But anyway, go on.
Coffee is never as good. It's been confusing to me how it even is allowed under international law unless you're a dual national. The idea of stripping someone of citizenship is a very difficult measure to take, and essentially puts them into a legal limbo, which the UN frowns upon. And it's hard for me to understand how that would. It's not hard for me to understand how it might benefit in a sort of short term the country in question that did it, but it's essentially externalizing your problem. It's essentially saying this person who is our citizen is too difficult for us to deal with, so we're going to leave him on the other side of the Eurostar line. I think your neighbors might have some problems with that eventually, because these people have to go somewhere. And so to me, it is an avoidance of the problem which externalizes it and is also, I think, questionable from legal and constitutional.
If I can just add to that. So as a former government official, I'm less averse to avoiding your problem. But I don't know how this would work. If the person still has a British passport and makes it, you know, to Paris or to the Channel, it seems to me that it will be a real problem to say, you know, no, you have to now, you know, live in a camp in France. I mean, there is, you know, I can see how it's desirable to discourage people from coming home. No question about that. And you know, there can be amendments, or you can do what the French did. You can have amendments on material support statutes so that anyone fighting with an extremist group is automatically, you know, subject to indictment. But I'm not sure that these exclusion orders really. I just don't know how they work. Kind of summon back that famous headline, you know, bad weather over Europe, continent cut off. Anyway, I don't know how it works.
All right, we've reached the end of our time. Please join me in thanking the panelists.